Colonel Rob Maness has a lifelong record of providing dedicated service to this nation. Having worked his way up from the enlisted ranks to full colonel, he served our country for more than 32 years. He has served as a bomber squadron commander, bomb disposal technician, Joint Chiefs of Staff Operations Officer, assisted the National Security Team with the campaign plan for the Global War on Terrorism. He authored the first theater nuclear war plan and served as the vice commander of America's largest airborne intelligence wing. Colonel Rob Maness is a true American hero. This is Rob Maness Live.
On Sunday, we reached an agreement with Iran that achieves everything we set out to accomplish, everything and much more. Ending the current conflict, reopening the Strait of Hormuz, and preventing Iran from ever obtaining a nuclear weapon. That's what it was all about. That was about 99%. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. They can't develop it, buy it. They can never have a nuclear weapon. At the same time, with this announcement, or close to it, as people started to think it was going to happen when Iran was making some very positive statements, the stock market has surged to record highs, picking up thousands of points over the last short period of time, thousands of points. And oil is dropping like it has never dropped before, at levels that went in numbers down $7, down $8. They've never seen anything like that. But if we didn't do this deal, we could have dropped more bombs for another 3 weeks, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 2 years. You would never have the Hormuz Strait open. You would never have success.
Folks, welcome back to the Rob Maness Show on Truth Thursday, and we're live on Worldview Tube and our X Spaces simulcast. Well, what's in the real MOU? What does President Trump's Iran agreement actually say? You just heard him at the G7 laying out the new framework. He made it clear technical discussions on removing every stockpile of enriched nuclear material begin right away. And unlike the old Obama deal that sent pallets of cash, any relief Iran gets has to be earned on merit, not handed over by the American taxpayers. Even the funds that is going to go, it's not going to be American tax dollars. And this is moving fast. Oil prices are already reacting in a positive way to the Strait of Hormuz opening. But big questions remain about verification, Iran's nuclear program, the terrorism funding, and what this means for Israel and our own national security. And we're joined once again by longtime TV news producer, former diplomat, and anchor at WABC Radio in New York, Jake Novak. Jake, welcome back to the show. Great to have you with us, man. We appreciate you. A lot of folks are having a tough time with this memorandum of understanding. Let's start with the economics piece of it, though. I mean, oil's started dropping almost right away, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and that's because for a couple of reasons. The biggest reason being that we have already seen today massive amounts of traffic go through the Strait of Hormuz. The Saudis got, I think, 3-4 tankers, something like that, earlier today, with millions of barrels on them in total, safely through the Strait. Actually, oil is finished with its sell-off for today. We're kind of at $76 a barrel, and I think it's done for the day as far as that's concerned. We saw 73 at one point. I think it'll be back in the 60s pretty quickly. So that's one part of it. But, of course, the other reason why is that Iran, one of the immediate parts of this deal, one of the things that they don't have to wait for is they can get their oil back onto the open market, which is, of course, a big deal for them and a big deal for the oil markets. It just adds to the supply even more. So we're seeing that. And these are all things that you can measure immediately. It's the tough things that you talked about down the road, this the verification of getting the nuclear material, how we're going to get it, how we can stop them from funding terror groups, which is all this regime really knows how to do, Rob. So, you know, Colonel, so I don't know how that's going to, you know, be achieved. That's going to be a tough one. And then, of course, to me, now, look, you and I want to get into the facts. I think the real journalists want to get into the facts of this deal just so that we can get the facts out there and people know what the facts are. So I'm not against that. But when it comes to analysis, Colonel, at the end of the day, I don't think it matters what's in the deal. It doesn't. What only thing that matters is this. Iran will break it. We know that Iran is going to break the deal. That's not even a debate, not for people who have been following this. So the only question is what President Trump will do when they break it. And I don't know if there's a president, certainly not in my lifetime, but ever in American history, that I would trust more to do something about a breaking of the deal than Donald Trump. Doesn't mean he will. I can't say 100%, but there's no president more than Trump who is likely to do something about it. And that's where I'm kind of hanging my hat today.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. President Trump's the only person I would trust with this kind of understanding starting out. You know, it's really a terms of reference, to use a lawyerly type term. It's the starting point, right? It's not a treaty. It's not even the deal. The deal is referenced in a future tense in this memo.
Yeah, and, look, getting to the Israeli part of it, what the Israelis have to do in the next couple of weeks is figure out how to maximize the benefits of all the things that have happened since last year, since Operation Midnight Hammer, and the destruction of so much of the Iranian military infrastructure, and the deaths of so much of the Iranian leadership. And they're going to have to figure out where this gives them an advantage as far as how they deal with Hezbollah. I think they already figured a lot of that out, but they want to be able to find new ways to cut off the pipeline between Iran and Hezbollah. And also working on the administration and saying, all right, we're doing what you've asked for. We have moved out of Lebanon. We're going to not do all those things that you didn't want us to do. But let's come to an understanding between the two of us about when we have the green light to go and hit Hezbollah. Or maybe we can have a different kind of green light paradigm for when we hit the supply chain. When they try to go through Iraq or some of these other countries, Syria and everything, to supply Hezbollah, is that part of this deal too? Because it probably isn't. And as you well know, in the years before Trump became president again, that was the MO for the Israelis a lot. They were hitting these supply chain operations to Hezbollah quite a bit in countries like Iraq and Syria. And if the Israelis have to go back to that to get relative peace, pre-October 7th-like peace, I think that they'll go for it. And but you can understand why they're complaining about this deal. I don't think anyone should be angry about them complaining about it. The only thing we shouldn't expect from them accept from the Israelis is some kind of, well, we can't, we've been completely betrayed type talk. I don't think that that's what we want to hear. And for, to his credit, Netanyahu is not saying that. So that's important.
Yeah. Let's talk about that a little bit, since you went there a little bit more earlier than I was going to. The vice president had the press conference today at the White House and gave another master's class on how to deal with the uppity press, man, which is great because, generally they get it wrong and they desire to get it wrong, unfortunately, for the American people and the world. But one of the things he said and was very clear about was that there is no way that the United States is going to stop Israel from defending itself. That is something that I think has to be part of any deal, even though Israel's not even mentioned in this piece of paper.
Yeah, and woe to any of the countries that think they're going to be able to attack Israel and get away with it because President Trump is going to stop them. There are some very minor examples of that, but in the past, but in the end, they were blown out anyway. For example, when Saddam Hussein used Scud missiles to attack Tel Aviv, and the Israelis listened to President George H.W. Bush and didn't retaliate. It isn't like Saddam survived that. I mean, they lost the war, and of course, he eventually ended up dead anyway years later. One or the other will punish you if you attack Israel. I think that anyone is stupid enough to think that they'll do that and get away with it. I think just about every single Hamas commander involved in October 7th has been killed, including another one last week. They're all gone. You're going to get killed. The idea that you can walk around thinking that you won't be punished for attacking Israel, either the Israelis themselves or the U.S. are going to get you. And I think it's important for a lot of people, especially here, supporters of Israel in this country, to remember that. No, I don't love all the aspects of this deal. But again, like I said to you right at the top, I am not going to get into the nitty gritty of this deal. I mean, I will for factual documentation purposes. That I want to make that clear. Yeah. But I'm not going to get upset about the nitty-gritty of the deal because I know Iran's going to break it. So now all I'm thinking about now is what happens when they do. That's what I'm spending my attentions and energy on.
Yeah. Let's stay on the Israeli government for a second, though, and J.D. Vance, because in the press conference, and this little segment, I caught most of the press conference, but I got this one really well. And he talked about Prime Minister Netanyahu and the other cabinet members. And he said essentially, hey, I'm really disappointed in the Israeli cabinet members that are coming at the president, in some cases with nasty personal attacks over this deal. But Prime Minister Netanyahu has not done that. So he gives him credit for that. But he also calls the other cabinet members out. And he doesn't do it in a mean way. He just says, look, let's face it. 2/3 of the weaponry that Israel has used to defend itself in this entire operation have come from the hands of Americans, and a lot of American tax dollars bought a lot of it to make sure that it got over there. And he's just musing out loud. He's like, hey, you know, if I was in your shoes, I would think twice about the personal attacks. It's okay to disagree, but to attack these guys, attack us personally, that's just really dumb.
Yeah, well, welcome to Israeli politics. You know, Israeli politicians, and Netanyahu has been guilty of this in the past. They are susceptible to the kind of, I mean, they are likely to commit acts of hyperbole that even American politicians don't commit, even when they talk about President Trump. I mean, there is no middle ground with Israeli politics. It's always death or life. It's always doomsday or not. They don't have a filter and they don't have a meter. And this is something that's bothered me for a long time, because they're in a very volatile part of the world. When they get very hyperbolic, it means something. It can really have a bad effect. So that's important to remember. It's also important to remember, Colonel, Israel has an election coming up. The sheer numbers are not lining up well at all for Netanyahu. They're simply not. The center right and even some of the right have aligned against him, along, of course, with, and they probably won't need to join with the far left or Arab parties or anything like that to win the election. And that is, I feels like an all foregone conclusion even before this deal came out. So that's another. So there you have some people who are trying to be the loudest voices in the hopes that this will get a popular front behind them so that they can, because the only question is which leader of which party is going to be the next prime minister. I don't think Netanyahu is going to survive this, but which one of the center right or right wing leaders is going to be the prime minister. And now they're all jockeying for that position. And sad to see, because I find Israeli politics to be really pathetic. Most politics are, but Israeli politics are pretty pathetic. And that's another context here. People need to understand, Vice President Vance needs to understand that these other members of the Israeli government, other than Netanyahu that he was talking about, they're all trying to be the next prime minister. He should realize that.
And if I gather what you're talking from correctly, then the further right you are and aggressive toward the Iranians, the more chances are you're going to win? Is that right?
Possibly. The more chance you're going to be able to get, well, let's put it this way. The more chance you're going to be able to get those people who have been supportive of Netanyahu for a long time to be okay with you being the prime minister of the government. You know, people should remember that back in 2022, that brief period when Naftali Bennett was prime minister of Israel for about a year, it was really a weak government. Bennett, for some reason, the Israeli politicians have had a real leadership vacuum for many years. Other than Benjamin Netanyahu, even on the right, there hasn't been anybody who's been really a competent, significant type of leader. I think Bennett will do a better job next time around if he is indeed the prime minister again, now that he's had that experience. Mm-hmm. He certainly didn't have the comfort in the job that he needed to have. And there's another story about that involving Ukraine that I can tell you about later. But what they're trying to do is make it sound like they are ready to take over Netanyahu's mantle. Because a lot of people who have supported Netanyahu don't want to vote for another party other than his party, but will this time want to make sure that it's somebody like him who will lead this new coalition government. So, yeah, you're on the right track with that thesis.
It seems like Netanyahu's probably been the most aggressive prime minister of Israel ever to handle these guys. I wouldn't want to, like, necessarily throw that baby out with the bathwater, but I'm just an American. I don't have anything. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we've got a question already in the audience, I think. We'll take that and talk about the nuclear material. That's the key part of this MOU and everything going forward for the United States of America. We'll be right back with Jake Novak.
Introducing Worldview Tube Vault. Over 35 years of radio broadcasts, television programs, documentaries, and ebooks. Plus, Worldviewpedia, our powerful search engine for instant worldview and Bible research. Join for as little as $7.99 a month. And now, Vault members get something brand new. Courses. Our very first course is here. The Book of Revelation with Brannon House. 53 in-depth lessons, complete with overview quizzes, walking you verse by verse through one of the most important books in Scripture. Getting started is simple. Go to worldviewtube.com/vault and join today. Already a member? Visit worldviewtube.com, click the person icon in the top right, and log in. Then hover over Vault in the menu and select Courses. That's it. You're in. Join WorldviewTube Vault today at worldviewtube.com/vault.
They'll work closely with us to turn over the so-called enriched material that's very deep in the bowels of the earth. Very deep. Nobody can get it. So it's not important that we do it quickly, but we could do it fairly quickly. When we have a chance, we'll do it. But in the meantime, we have cameras on every inch of it. Nobody can do it. And if they do, we'll hit them with Patriots. That's all. And they'll be gone. And they know that. Technical discussions on the removal of all stockpiles of enriched materials will begin immediately. We're going to start that immediately. And unlike Barack Hussein Obama, who sent Iran pallets of cash and any relief they receive under this deal, they'll have to get based on merit. And it won't be from us. We don't have to give them anything.
Welcome back to the Rob Manis Show. It's Truth Thursday, and we're talking about the truth of the MOU with between the United States and Iran with our guest, Jake Novak, who's a great anchor on a great show out of WABC in New York nowadays, really bringing lots of good information, dives really deep into a lot of things, and this is one of them, I know. Jake, I think I've got a question in the audience. Let's take that before we get into this nuclear piece real quick. Michelle, go ahead.
So we no longer had a hand up.
Okay. Okay. All right. No problem. The nuclear piece. Look, there has been some experience recovering pulverized nuclear weapons level material from aircraft crashes, you know, ground detonations, and those kind of things, but nothing at the level of over 1,000 pounds of this stuff. That's deeply buried in really heavy rock and now dirt and those kind of things. That's a pretty big lift, just the operation of that, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, there's also reports which sound a little like Iranian bluster to me. They're very good at that. That say they've also booby-trapped all the entrances. So I don't know if that's true or not. Who would want to lay those explosives? I'm not really sure who would want to do that job. Whatever it is, it does appear to be inaccessible at the moment. Mm-hmm. I say that appear to be, though, underline that, because, you know, I do have a worry that some of it was able to be, that the Iranians were able to recover and remove some of it before all of this happened, whatever collapsing of mines or tunnels or things like that. We need to really make sure that it really is all under that rubble. We really need to make sure. And by the way, thankfully, it's not that hard to find out. That stuff leaves a trace. It leaves chemical traces. It leaves other kinds of traces. We should be able to find out if some of that material is not there. And I would make that a really high priority, not to just take them on their word for it. But, you know, it's funny. What the president said in that soundbite is exactly what I said on my show when we first got that report, mm-hmm. that it was buried under a bunch of stuff. I said this actually may have been a turning point in the negotiations. If it's in a place where not even the Iranians can get it, then whatever obstinance they have about turning it over is moot. Doesn't matter. They can't get to it either. And I think that actually was a breakthrough in the negotiations. And it might have been something the Iranians did to themselves. If the Iranians indeed collapsed these mines and made it impossible and tunnels and things like that to get mm-hmm. to the material, they may have undermined their own negotiating position, because in de facto terms, nobody has it anymore. Right. So that, it to me, was something that made me smile. I immediately realized this because it was a CNN report. I think it was Saturday, but it might have been last week. Was it a week ago Saturday or this Saturday? But it was one Saturday and I was live on the air And that's exactly how I analyzed it. I said, wait a minute, this could be the breakthrough in negotiations. And I think it was. And it should be noted that the Iranians may have hoisted themselves. You know, however favorable you think this deal is to them, first of all, doesn't matter because they're not going to uphold it. But don't worry about that so much. The thing that they were really looking to hang their hat on and keep and maybe draw us into a longer and maybe even a ground war was over this material. And they may have taken their own chess piece off the table on that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the mountain complexes that you hit, that the material was supposedly in, that I've always said, and you've been on this show with me many times, I've always said that it's possible they could have moved some of that stuff beforehand.
Right.
Now, we're tracking on it, I'm sure, wherever it was. But they also could have done some things that we couldn't see, and that is put secure chambers in those complexes and move the material into it to be able to block it off from the attack from the OAB bombs, the mothers of all bomb penetrators, the MOP penetrators. And that's possible too, but both ends end up with it being deeply buried under a lot of hard rubble.
Deeply. And what would we have done with it when we got it? We would have buried it deep under a bunch of
rubble. Well, I know where the facility is.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know it. So, I think it's kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other. It's one thing to smile about in the last couple of days about all this, in addition to a couple of other things, which I don't want us to go too far into this program. It's your show, Colonel, but I think you'll agree with me 100%. Can we absolutely celebrate today one thing, whether you're happy with the deal with not, or whether in the fact that we had such a low casualty rate for a long drawn out conflict with a heavily militarized opponent, and the civilian casualties are almost unmeasurably low. I mean, we really didn't have massive civilian casualties here. We didn't really have any significant civilian casualties at all. I know we know about that school and the first day of bombing, which may or may not have been the United States' fault. And that was tragic. I think the casualty list there was 100 dead. That's terrible. Yeah. I get it. But 100 dead for 4 months and change of war. And I know a lot of it was under ceasefire. But as you know, we had to stop ceasefires here and there in that time as well. I'm sorry, but anyone who would have predicted only 13 American dead troops would have been laughed at in February. And now we can smile at it because it's true.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a whole host of good news for the Allied side in this, and included in this deal, you know, for the Iranians to at all put themselves on a piece of paper that says we will not procure or develop a nuclear weapon at all. That is a win.
Yeah, and that's right, because it's so definitive. You know, we have been the ones who've been saying Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. Israel's been the ones who've been saying it all along. And there's been a somewhat tacit approval of that by the rest of the world. But there's never been Iran saying, no, we won't do this. They've never agreed to that. In the Obama deal, they just said, we're going to give it in 10 years, which they didn't uphold. Of course, they immediately broke it by starting to move some of their nuclear research into actual the city of Tehran. And the UN, not the Israelis, the UN proved that with their own investigation, if people remember back in 2020 when that was revealed, or late 2019. So now for the first time, the Iranians are saying, we're not going to do this. And they're not even putting a timeline on it. They're saying, we're not going to do this. Now, again, I don't expect them to uphold the deal. I think they'll be on the phone to Pakistan and North Korea as soon as they possibly can. But the fact that they've said this now in the international courts of law and in the UN, the United States is no longer just making it sound like we're being bullies, taking something from Iran only and picking and choosing. It's Iran itself, which has made this agreement and made this promise. And that changes a lot. It does change a lot, even though functionally, I think they're going to work like hell to break that promise.
So do you think this is an elegant trap, to use a Donald Trump word, a very elegant trap?
A little bit more than that. I wish it were just an elegant trap. I haven't told that to those of my friends and colleagues who are very, very worried and upset about this deal. And I'm trying to calm them as best I can. But no, I don't think it's a completely elegant trap. I think there's an aspect of it. I mean, it definitely puts us in a parameter of a better position the next time we have to go do something like this, which may be very soon. So that's great. But what this seems more like to me is the president and some of his top advisors saying, We beat the hell out of the Iranian regime. It's an entirely new group of people, same ideology, same Cub Scout troop, but same people. Let's see if we can get a new paradigm with this group that will require less of pain from our side, less terrorism in that region. And let's see if that's worth a try, because we know all we're going to get is immediate pain if we continue the same policies with them. Yeah. That could be debated about whether that's smart or not, but this isn't Nazi Germany. This isn't like, well, you know, we couldn't go with Admiral Dönitz after Hitler was dead, because come on, it's the same Nazi regime, and they had a world and they had had all of the continent of Europe under their thumb for quite some time, for 5-6 years, right? So it's a little different than that. Iran was just threatening to do that, and that's bad enough, but okay. So I think that there's some logic and validity to trying this out. But you're right. The fact that you have the Iranian regime now saying no nuclear weapon, this gives us much more latitude and justification to move in as quickly as we like when they break the deal.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. On the nuclear issue, I believe today that the United States is the only nation state that has the technical capability to go in and recover this stuff safely and get it stored somewhere where it can be, stored away from their hands and those kind of things. There's not any other country that has that capability, is there?
I would highly doubt it. I would highly doubt it. The nuclear, you know, obviously this is never going to be fully published in all the details of how Israel became a nuclear power. You know, we know some of it. We know that some of the material definitely came from the United States. We know that they made a lot out of a little, and there's a debate about whether they were capable at the time of the darkest days of the Yom Kippur War. You know, did Golda Meir, did she or did she not order the Air Force not to arm their bombers with nuclear bombs? That'll probably never be revealed. I don't expect ever to find that out, but that is the question.
Yeah.
But it's a long way of me giving you an answer that what Israel experiences with is much less material than this. They don't have that kind of experience, certainly not in the crude form that the Iranians have it in. So I think you'd be right. It's possible that Pakistan has some scientists who were the disciples of A.Q. Khan, who made Pakistan a nuclear power. It's possible some of his people could do it. Would we trust them to do it? No.
No.
But it's possible that they could. But it's a good bet it is just the United States.
Yeah, I mean, we even did it for the old Soviet Union. Took some of their old material and put it in our storage for them because they didn't have the capability.
And they also didn't maintain it properly. We found so many of their missile silos filled with water when we did our trust but verify inspections. And I know some of the inspectors who were there and broke out laughing. They were like, I didn't have to come here. These missiles never would have left the ground, let alone with nuclear capability.
I'll never forget General Lee Butler, who was the last Air Force commander of Strategic Air Command, coming back from his trip just before the wall, or I think it was after the wall came down, SAC went away, and said, you know, as soon as he saw the grass knee-high growing up out of the taxiways and even the runway he landed on and the ramps and the maintenance, state of maintenance on the aircraft and those kind of things, he began to question, why have we expended these last 50 years with Americans on hair trigger alert every day, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year? You know, that's a lot of treasure and a lot of time. We lost people in the process during training and operations and those kind of things. And General Butler was like, these people are, this threat was nowhere near what we thought it was.
Well, better to overestimate an enemy than to underestimate
it. Well, yeah, absolutely. So it's just that my only point with that is sometimes the reality is a lot different than what the intelligence is telling you from a military perspective, and our military intelligence is pretty darn good. Darn good.
And don't forget, this is not to denigrate the Soviet military and engineering know-how. It's excellent. It's very, very good. It was the implementation and the infrastructure and the fact that they don't have a capitalist structure. I mean, our defense contractors, love them or hate them, They are mostly capitalist enterprises. Now, of course, their only real client is the U.S. government, so they're almost like a public utility in a way, but they're better than the public utilities. Let's face it, they are. And they work much more efficiently and have a much higher standard than a bunch of government workers. Who knows whose brother or whose cousin was in charge of that runway or in charge of that missile silo. Sure. But the actual technological experts who build their weapons tech, they're nothing to laugh at. And people who think Russia's just some kind of gas station in Europe really don't understand how good their engineering education and culture is in that country.
Yeah, I track it closely, and they're very, very good. It's nothing to sneeze at. We got to take another break. When we come back, we'll talk about the money piece. I want to get your take on this, especially as a former diplomat. How do you think this will look from the Gulf States perspective? Because that's who it's dependent on. We'll be right back with Jake Novak.
At a certain age, you stop chasing younger. You start protecting what helps you feel steady, strong, and well. Your body's collagen matters. It supports the structure of your skin, joints, and connective tissue. But as the years go by, your body needs more support from the inside. That's where Bella Grace Elixir comes in. Bella Grace Elixir combines Verisol collagen, the world's most clinically proven collagen, with Astereal astaxanthin and cat's claw in a proprietary blend designed to help support the processes that reconstruct collagen, while also offering antioxidant and anti-inflammatory effects. And this isn't just for women. It's for men and women who want to age with more confidence, more care, and a daily wellness routine that supports the body from within. One simple elixir, thoughtfully formulated for whole body wellness. Take care of the body that has carried you this far. Order Bella Grace Elixir today at melissahousebg.com.
You mentioned a $300 billion fund. I got to be very clear about this. Not a single cent of American money under any circumstance, no matter what the Iranians do, goes to Iran. Not a single cent of American money.
But they get other money.
Well, here's what this says. This says, for example, let's say that the United Arab Emirates, who have been a great ally, let's say they want to invest in a power plant in Iran. What this deal provides is that if the Iranians have done everything we require them to do, then we will allow the United Arab Emirates to do that, because they can't do that right now without American approval. So we're fundamentally saying if the Iranians transform how they interact with the world, we will transform how the world economy interacts with Iran. But if they don't do any of that stuff, they don't get any of these benefits. So I think all the Democrats who are saying, well, the Iranians get all these things, they don't get anything unless the total unless there's been a complete transformation of how Iran interacts with the world. That would be a huge win for America. And to Jesse's point, if they don't do any of these things, we don't give them anything. They don't receive anything. Their nuclear program is still destroyed. Their military is still destroyed. Their missile program and industrial base is still destroyed. We fundamentally have transformed the Middle East. Whether they comply or not, this is just icing on the cake, assuming they do all the right things.
Welcome back to the Rob Manis Show. It's Truth Thursday. We're talking about the truth of the MUO between the United States and Iran as the starting point, the shoving off point of the deal that the president of the United States is eventually, in his mind, going to make with the Iranians that will result in a number of things. And J.D. Vance was talking about one of those things that has some people up in arms. The $300 billion has people up in arms quite often and frequently in this country. And they're saying things like, well, that just sounds like the JCPOA. And for those of you that aren't initiated, that's the Obama plan. So some of you are saying, boy, he's just like Obama. Okay, people. All right, let's get it. Jake Novak's take on this. He's got a lot of experience in this part of the world, in the diplomatic world, and those kind of things. And Jake, one of the big questions I have about this is the Gulf Arab states. JD was, he even mentioned one. That's where this dollar investment level is intended to come from, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm really glad he mentioned the United Arab Emirates, because you know what the United Arab Emirates just did, Colonel? They just left OPEC. And why did they leave OPEC? Because What a lot of the Sunni Gulf states have been willing to do for many decades, even though they are vicious enemies of Iran, Iran treats them worse. And the UAE took a lot of pain during this war, a lot of it.
Yeah.
But the Sunni Gulf Arab states for years have been willing to do business in a tangential, parallel way with the Iranians. All right, we'll be in OPEC with them. But we're not going to invest in Iran. We're not going to go in there until there's regime change to do any kind of investment in that country. And that is why this whole number to me is actually a major capitulation by Iran, because the only way they're going to see any of that money from a Gulf Arab state, they're more likely to get it from Trump, frankly, than from those states, is until there's major regime change, major capitulation on their part. The fact that the UAE left OPEC, which I would assume 99% of the people criticizing this deal from, you know, the rank and file in this country, Trump haters, whatever, don't even remember. It was a whole 2 months ago. How could we forget? How could we remember that? But
exactly.
That was a really, really big story for me. I thought that was a huge deal, because it showed that these Sunni countries that have been at war with Shia Muslim Islam for almost 1,400 years, but specifically with Iran for almost 50 years, they don't want to even do business in, they don't even want to be in the club with them anymore. They don't, because they just it's just not worth it for them. And so the idea that the UAE would put money into Iran when they just said we're not even going to be in the same room trading money with them is a real stretch. And if the Iranians signed this deal thinking we're going to get this money, then they're the suckers here. That's for sure.
Yeah. So what does the UAE or any of the Gulf states need to see? They're all Sunni, right? If I understand it correctly. Let's dive into that again. What does a country like the UAE, especially them, what will they need to see in order for them to make investments in Iran?
Well, they're not going to do anything. I don't think that the only thing that they would be interested in doing is getting their hooks into some of the Iranian oil infrastructure. They'd love to be able to add to it, modernize it, get more of a stake in it. They might help rebuild. We might hear the UAE and the Saudis say, hey, we'll help you rebuild some of these oil facilities that may have been destroyed or damaged during the war. But the idea, you know, J.D. Vance threw out a public utility example. The idea that they would want to build a hotel there, which, by the way, there's a lot of parts of Iran that, you know, if Iran had a real regime that we could deal with, I'd love to build some, you know, I'd love to go to a hotel on some of their places, but that's just not happening right now. Yeah. The idea that the UAE would make any kind of investment in anything other than Gulf oil traffic and that business with Iran is a ridiculous stretch at this point. It would take an absolutely totally new regime. It would probably take a regime that includes non-Shia Muslims in the leadership or in some kind of confederation. I don't want to see Iran balkanized like Iraq is, but it's better than what they have now. So maybe you give the Kurds some control. Maybe you give some of the Sunnis in that area some control. I don't know what you can do. But honestly, they are not interested in any of the possibilities here. We're not talking about building office buildings or tech or resorts or any, you know, don't think we're not going to have another Dubai in Iran. And it's just not going to happen. They may want to invest and get some equity in the rebuild. And again, that wouldn't even be them either. Remember, these aren't even UAE companies. These are companies that they have investment stakes in. So probably a lot of American companies that getting paid UAE money might work and do some work there. But I don't even see that happening, because Americans won't feel safe working there. What American family is going to want to get a contractor job over there? Will the French do it? I don't think the French and the UAE have that kind of relationship. Honestly, this is really a great part of the deal, in my opinion, because I just don't think it's going to happen at all, let alone not U.S. dollars. I don't think it's going to be, you know, UAE money either, euros or whatever their favorite currency is.
What do you think the president thinks? I mean, the countries, obviously, he went to them and they had to say yes to, for a reason, to allow this to be put in the MOU. Right, as a carrot and as a verification measure, really. I think that's even more important part of this.
Well, I think they came to him. I think the UAE and Bahrain and to some extent Saudi Arabia came to them. Now, Saudi Arabia was the country, we know this for a fact, and this has been, it was quickly reported by the Washington Post and then no one picked up on it, which is frustrating to me. Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia made something like 15 phone calls to President Trump in the days before the February 28th beginning of the war, or whatever the day was. The Saudis were really lobbying for this war much harder than anyone else. And then it seems like they came along with the UAE and Bahrain and asked for some relief from all the Iranian missile attacks. So I think what the president is saying, like, okay, but if we push them on this and we stop this, then you're going to have to pledge some money. And they're like, okay, we'll pledge some money. What does that matter? Okay. It's a pledge and we're never going to actually have to pay it. And they wanted relief. They wanted immediate relief. The UAE and even Saudi Arabia, and certainly Bahrain, have never experienced the kind of barrage that they took during this war. They've never experienced anything like that. The Saudis have a little bit more experience with it because of the Houthi attacks on them from Yemen. But the UAE and Bahrain were really, really knocked back on this. And they must really, really be happy because, again, all they've had to do is make a promise for investments that no one is going to pressure them in the end of the day to make. At the end of the day, they just had to make the pledge. The actual payment, they're not going to get a cup. You know, the repo men aren't coming to the UAE's door to collect that pledge. I promise you.
So what's in it for the Egyptians? I saw General Sisi. I call him General. I know he's the president. He's still an Egyptian general. You know, sitting with the president at the G7 for quite a long time. I'm sure they were behind some of this stuff, trying to help make it happen, because they owe us, right?
You know, the Egyptians have become, isn't it amazing how irrelevant Egypt has become in the region compared to where it was 50 years ago? It was the dominant nation in the Arab world and in the Middle East, had the biggest population, had the biggest army. And now it's almost an afterthought. It's a client state of the Saudis who basically bankroll that country. They still have a large population. They still have a large army, one that hasn't been tested and worked in any way whatsoever in well over 50 years. Forget about 50, more like 53 years. They're like the Knicks. They haven't fought since 1973. We should call the Egyptians the Knicks, but they're not going to be winning any championships soon. So what they get out of the deal is they get an unmolested Saudi Arabia. Their benefactor is now less bothered and can go about its business. Egypt has so far to go. It is an incredibly, still very backward country. The rate of illiteracy there is through the roof. And like I said, their best asset that they had during all the early years of the Arab-Israeli conflict, for example, was the fact that they had a pretty well-trained and large army. But I don't think that army is anywhere near anywhere near prepared for anything at this point. I really don't. They get a lot of money. I think they have a lot of sons of aristocrats who fly those jets around. And, you know, and they don't even have that much oil, really. They don't have any. So they're just there, and they are controlled by Saudi Arabia. So if you want to know what Egypt is doing, just look what Saudi Arabia does, and then you have your answer.
And, of course, the Turks have been mentioned as key partners in putting this thing together, which didn't really surprise me. The only thing that surprised me is Erdogan didn't try to get a lot of press out of it.
Yeah, he must not have liked this. I think he may not have liked the easy resolution here. I think he was hoping for this thing to drag on longer and longer and to make them more of a player in this deal. And, yeah, we hear that they were a part of the negotiations and stuff, but we certainly didn't see it that much. And I agree with you. I mean, if they had really played that kind of a role, Erdogan would have been all over it, and he's been quiet. So that tells you a lot, too.
Yeah, don't be surprised, folks, if you see later on that the president intentionally has put him in a little box to reduce the threat of the neo-Ottoman empire that he wants to build, because he's actually stated that, right?
Yeah, it's insane. Turkey has, you know, there's so many countries in the Middle East that just keep making these really bad choices. You know, Lebanon has decided that it really still, despite a little bit of the pushback on Hezbollah and Iran, it still has decided that it hates Israel more. I mean, what a stupid move. They just keep making the stupid moves. And Turkey does, too.
Yeah.
I mean, Turkey could have been for a long time a voice of reason in the whole region and listen to the example of Ataturk and all that kind of stuff about being moderate about things religiously. And instead, 20 years ago or so, they elected this Erdogan, who has taken advantage of the opposite way of thinking. And they're just another dime a dozen. What is another Islamist voice in the region going to, how are they going to stand out in any way? It's really asking someone to create a great new airport who happens to be a horse trainer. I mean, that's Erdogan. He's a horse trainer being asked to create an airport. And it's a bad mix.
That's a great analogy. All right, we got one more break when we come back. We'll be talking with Jake Novak. I want to get into a little bit about the IRGC that's left and this whole Syria-Lebanon thing that the president mentioned that I saw yesterday. I got to get a take on that from Jake Novak. We'll be right back.
Take a look at the water you just poured. It looks clean. It tastes fine. But what's really in it? Lead? Fluoride? Arsenic? Chlorine? Pesticides? PFAS forever chemicals? Pharmaceutical residues? And bacteria? Every single day, these toxins flow straight from your tap into your glass, into your family. It's time for Century H2O from Worldview Water. Century H2O is the ultimate water treatment technology, designed to remove harmful toxins, balance your water's pH, and enrich it with essential minerals like calcium and magnesium, the way nature intended. From commercial-scale systems to whole-house filtration to crisp, delicious drinking water right at your kitchen sink and shower, Century H2O delivers cleaner, healthier water everywhere you need it. No plumber, no tools, no plumbing knowledge required. Perfect for homes, apartments, rentals, RVs, refrigerators, and more. Because everyone deserves access to clean, healthy water. Visit worldviewwater.net. That's worldviewwater.net.
Pakistanis who have been helpful in mediating this agreement with the Iranians, they've asked us not to release the full text for a little while. It'll come out at the latest on Friday. We're actually trying to push them to get it out today because we want to tell the American people what's in this deal. It's fundamentally a good deal for the American people, but it's also very simple, and I've also seen some misrepresentations about it. So in short, what it does is it opens the Strait of Hormuz immediately. This is why you see oil prices down in the 70s from a high in the 120s, is because you're seeing the Strait already open its traffic to the flow of oil and gas. It also provides a framework whereby if the Iranians give us what we need on stopping the funding of terrorism, on no longer pursuing a nuclear weapon, then they can get some benefits, be reinvited into the world economy. And when I say benefits, I'm talking about sanctions relief on their economy. We've destroyed their nuclear program, but one of the things the president is trying to do is give them the incentive not to try to rebuild that program for the long haul, so that it's not just us. We don't have to worry about Iran having a nuclear weapon for the next couple of years, but for the next generation, that generation doesn't have to worry about it either.
Welcome back to the Rob Maynard Show. It's all about the truth today on Truth Thursday. There was a lot of misinformation in the 48 hours before the MOU text was actually released, and it was released by the Iranians first, and then the White House released the memo too. Jake Novak's my guest today. Jake, I just got to ask, I mean, what is in it for the people that were releasing it? I suspect the remnants of the IRGC are probably one of those groups. I can understand that they would want to stir things up and get as much disinformation out there as possible. But other entities, it's been rumored that might have leaked it, like other countries like Turkey or Syria or even Israel or Republicans. Neocon types, as they're called here in the United States, that might have done these releases of not quite the memo, but they're just talking about it. It seems a little nutty when you have stakes this high to me.
Well, I think people knew that the way that journalists and other people are going to look at that release is they're immediately going to look at that number. So we knew that we were going to get that $300 billion number focused on, and they got what they wanted. They got people talking for a day and a half or so about how the United States was going to give Iran $300 billion. I'm still getting texts from people about that, which of course is not true.
I got one before the show.
Yeah, so it's a big joke. That's what they wanted, and that's what they got. And to them, this is the way they act. I mean, it's just hit and run type stuff. So I think that was the motivation. And to try to create that kind of narrative really quickly. And there you go. I wish it were more detailed and nuanced than that, but we're dealing with real childish people. You know, the childishness of it is really frustrating to me. The idea that, oh, President Trump is going to hand over big money, or that this is a huge victory for Iran. I mean, that's just it's too simplistic. And I actually think that you could really make a strong argument that it's not necessarily a big win for the U.S. or Israel. But this deal, the fact that they signed some of this stuff because of some of the things we've talked about so far in this program, is really a huge loss for Iran. I mean, anyone who really knows these other Gulf countries, and again, I'll say it again, they really think they're going to get $300 billion of investment from the UAE, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, those kind of, that's insane. There's no way. Absolutely no way. And Iran signed the, on the dotted line with that kind of, I mean, that's the real great pumpkin, you know, that's Iran acting like Sally and Linus and running after Linus and the great pumpkin. It's not coming. They're not going to get that money. So the fact that they signed that and they even think that they might get it, or they thought that it was, even if they don't think they're going to get it, well, it was worth signing because maybe there's a 1% chance. That's pathetic. When you sign a deal thinking that some major part of it is only a small chance of happening, but you're willing to sign because of the small chance, you lost. Simple deduction though.
Yeah, when you add that to the statement about nuclear weapons, I mean, that's, there's no doubt in my mind that Iran is at a complete loss here from the perspective of the Mullah's government. Now, the IRGC, which is really the organization that was really running the country and keeping the Mullahs in power, and still is, you know, the Mullah that's been named to power, last I told his son, you know, even though he's severely injured from what we can gather, he's only there because the IRGC leadership wanted him there. And the guy that is now the commander of the IRGC was also the Quds Force commander. So, you know, when I see that, and I see the Hezbollah-Lebanon peace is still very much in play for the Iranians, at least from a rhetorical perspective. That's where I kind of land with you, is that they're not going to keep this deal. We're going to, whether it's a trap set by the president or a trap set by themselves, you know, we're going to be back into military operations, I believe. I don't know how long it'll take, but they'll get caught.
They don't have anything. They don't know how to do anything else other than support foreign terror proxy armies. That's what they do. That's really what they're interested in. That's what their entire regime has been set up to do. That's the infrastructure for it. And they don't really know what else to do. So it's not like they're going to suddenly say, okay, let's work on fixing the plumbing here in Tehran. I mean, they're not interested in that. They also don't really it's a classic, they're hammers and all they're going to see is everything is a nail type thing. And it's just inevitable that they will break the deal. It's not necessarily, when I say that, people say, oh, do you mean Taqiya and the whole supposed Muslim belief in lying? No, it's got nothing. I'm not talking about DNA or cultural things here. I'm talking about the way the regime functions, the way the regime functions to do this. This is their oxygen. And it will take an entirely different regime before we can think about anything being upheld. This is not a cultural, religious, or anything commentary on my part, which, you know, that's another discussion. I'm not saying it's a worthless discussion, but that's not why I'm coming to this conclusion. It's because this is what that regime is set up to do. I mean, that's it.
Yeah, and I'm not even saying what I said as a criticism of the plan on the president's part, because I think he's got that baked into this whole operation going forward. You have to. You know, all of us have been watching this. I've been dealing with the Iranians even before they went to war with us as the mullahs. I've got a cousin that's an adopted orphan out of the oil fields of Iran. My uncle worked over there building that infrastructure and found him, saved his life. You know, so I'm fairly familiar with the Iranian people, this government for sure, having been in uniform the whole time that they've been in existence, trying to kill people like me. And I mean that in all sincerity. So I'm not even criticizing the deal. I think this is the president and J.D. Vance have baked it into this as part of the structure that this is going to happen if you break this, knowing that the likelihood is high that they will break the deal in more ways than one. Let's talk about the Syria piece and Lebanon. That I saw the president talk about it. He really likes this Jelani guy, which you can't trust that guy as far as you could spit him as far as I'm concerned. He's Al-Qaeda, you know, through and through. And I still question the United States' involvement in putting this guy in power, to be honest with you. And I think I'm right to do that, and I'm right to not trust him. But the president seems to think that he should be the one to handle the Lebanon issue. Where is that coming from?
I mean, I think it's coming from just throwing hands up there. Maybe that's actually a call for help. Maybe the president and some of the American leaders are hoping that someone else will stand up and say, what about me? Mm-hmm. I understand that you got a friendship with him, and I don't want to kill Jolani, but I think I would like to be involved in a real national election and prove that I can be a better leader. Maybe that's the president hoping to beat the ground and see if there's somebody else who would like to step forward, who might actually be trustworthy, or at least want to do right by most of the Syrian people. It is such a head scratcher, but it's one of those things where no one else has gotten it right ever. We've never had a responsible leadership in Syria ever. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I think the Israeli government is aligned with the president on this, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, because again, they just feel like this is an early stage type situation and there's lines of communication open. Assad was such a major roadblock. When Israel and the Palestinian Authority were making their peace deals in 1993 mm-hmm. and 94, I know the people who were involved in a lot of those negotiations, and there was real hope. There actually were American envoys who secretly went to Damascus. I have a gift from one of them down in my basement, an actual original wonderful backgammon set from the marketplace in Damascus that I got from him. So I have physical proof that they were there. Believe it or not, this is 32 years ago. There was hope that they would join in some part of that negotiation. It never happened because Assad was just such a stumbling block. Yeah. So they look at this Jolani guy as just someone who might be a little bit more reasonable and someone that they can make a deal with without having to trust. In other words, mm-hmm. they'll get some type of some kind of concession from him, take that to the bank, and then they don't have to worry about him upholding parts of the deal after that. You know, it's mm-hmm. such a mess. You know, we are really dealing with, you know, if we didn't have the jet airplane and drones and things mm-hmm. like that, we could really be isolationists, couldn't we? We could really say, let's just build a fence around all these countries and let them come and give them a few centuries to get somewhere near our level of culture and advancement. But we can't. We can't. It's a moot argument. They can get to us. 9/11 yeah. should have proved that to you, but you shouldn't figure that out 30 years before 9/11 too, if you didn't already. And yeah. we can't do that. And because we can't do that, we're going to have to make some deals with some really, really bad people. And compared to the Cold War, the list is short. The list is short.
It is.
The Cold War had a lot more fraught and problematic relationships than one or two people that we've mentioned today.
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest things I'm worried about is the Christian populations in those areas. They've been really oppressed and persecuted a lot, especially since the Iraq war. Doesn't seem like they're on anybody's radar right now. Hopefully I'm wrong about that. And the administration's looking at that, because that's a big problem, especially when you give that much power to a Jolani type and those kind of things. So from the perspective of the Israelis, they're not even named in this MOU, but as we close this out, let's come back to the Israelis. JD said, hey, Israel has a right to defend itself, just like the Iranians do. And the president was talking about them having some limited number of missiles and limited range missile defense and those kind of things. So I don't think anybody's under any illusion that Hezbollah is going to stop or that some other, you know, Muslim entity is going to start attacking Israel again. From a Lebanon perspective, got about a minute left. What do you think the plan is on Prime Minister Netanyahu's part? I mean, he's gone all the way up to the river, I believe, and they're cleaning all that out, which is really where the heavy Hezbollah presence was.
Yeah, well, they are retreating now. I mean, that's been the last 2 days. Israeli forces have been retreating for that. I assume they will get completely out of Lebanon by tomorrow or however long that takes. Mm-hmm. What the plan now for the Israelis must be is to make real clear communications with the White House, what the parameters are. Yeah. You know, when will the United States forget about just allowing Israel to retaliate against Hezbollah attacks, but when will there be certain events where even the president won't make a comment saying, oh, this is, I wish they didn't do this. Because I think there was a lot of that the last couple of weeks where the United States pretty much allowed it, but the president wanted to publicly denounce it or push back on it. And I think that that needs to be the number one priority for the Israelis right now. Tell us, Mr. President, tell us, J.D. Vance, what are the rules that you'd like us to follow, the rules of engagement that you'd like us to follow with Hezbollah? Because we'd like to answer every drone attack. We'd like to answer every missile attack. But but we would like to have exactly what rules you'd like us to follow. And they also need to say, what if we have a Rapallo type agreement in Iran? For those of you who remember, after the Treaty of Versailles, Germany had to disarm. And then a few years later, Germany signed some treaties that allowed them to get some armaments. We're not going to have any public treaty signing with China or Russia when they try to rearm Iran, or may already be.
No, they're already talking.
They're already talking, right? So the Israelis need to find out, hey, wait a minute. At what level of rearmament do we also get a get out of jail free card from you guys? And I think that that needs to be the discussion now, with the good faith of, hey, look, we retreated out of Lebanon, and that's now we start a new discussion.
All right, well, Jake, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Very good discussion, enlightening.